My name is Michael Pellet, and I teach theology at the Lutheran Seminary in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, Canada. And the sessions this week are, in general, entitled Hygienics of the Soul, a kind of tongue-in-cheek title, because what I really want to look at is what the church is doing, what Christianity is doing with regard to the body. That so much of the Christian tradition has been with concern for the soul, such that the body, and I want to use the body as a metaphor for the whole material world and all of creation, seems to have been neglected. And so at times our physical bodies, or even within the church itself, the sense of the body of Christ with regard to politics, the body politic, and then of course the cosmic body of creation has been neglected. And in the first session that we had, we talked about a little bit about why it has been neglected and the difference between the Greek philosophical way of looking at the world and what that entails over against the biblical way, seen both in the Hebrew scriptures and in the New Testament with regard to the concepts of shalom and wholeness. And how often shalom has been translated as peace, which is indeed an accurate translation, but the concept of shalom as peace entails more than just the absence of conflict, whether that be internal or external conflict. But that notion of shalom is a sense of wholeness, of well-being, of the entire relationship of who we are with God and God's relationship with us, and how that embraces us within the whole scope of creation. And so we looked at that concept of shalom in passages like Ephesians chapter 2, verses 14 to 19, Mark chapter 5, verses 25 to 34, and Luke chapter 7, verses 36 to 50. In yesterday's session, entitled Resurrection and Creation, the basic claim there that I made was that a Christian interpretation of creation does not automatically turn to Genesis 1 and 2. That for Christians to understand what creation is all about, and if you will, to talk about the paradigmatic event of creation, the image of creation, we look at the resurrection. Because in the resurrection, we see God's creative and redemptive activities. And so for us as Christians, passages like Romans chapter 8, or Colossians chapter 1, verses 15 through 20, are those passages which help us to understand the full, complete Christian view of creation, and how we see that creation provides the environment, right? Or I use the German word here, Umwelt. Right, that surrounding world, creation is that environment, that Umwelt, in which the relationship or the dialogue between God and humanity takes place. Right. And of course, because creation is that stage, that context, that environment for the dialogue, it is involved in that dialogue and it affects and effects that dialogue. But that dialogue between God and the human being unfolds in creation in terms like sin and grace. And here again, faith is an important ingredient of that, and we talked about the role of faith as we talked about things like baptism and all sorts of other topics that got us going on certain things. The key to this, again, is that the significance in all of this is that in the resurrection of Jesus, God takes up afresh the divine and faithful initiative as creator. Thus, creation confronts us with a question and includes us in a promise. Namely, do we believe the promises of the gospel that God is a God of life? Now today, I want to talk about animals and anthropocentrism. And again, anthropocentrism is, we keep our circle here for creation. An anthropocentric kind of view sees the human being as the focus and center of all creation, and that somehow creation is centered in and for the human, in such a way that all things within creation are to serve the purposes of the human being. Anthropos is the Greek word for human, and centrism, centered. So a very human-centered point of view. Where did that kind of human-centered point of view come from? How was that developed? Many are going to claim that that whole human-centered focusing only on human beings and nothing else is the biblical tradition. That's what the Christian tradition and the biblical tradition is all about. The question we have to ask is that an accurate reading of the scriptures? Secondly, where did this human-centered tradition come from? Here we'll have to do a little history of philosophy, and we can see that this notion of a very human-centered world came into prominence during that period of time in Western civilization known as the Enlightenment. This was a time in philosophical and scientific thinking where folks see themselves as coming out of quote-unquote the Dark Ages and now becoming enlightened. And what really enlightened them? Well, we're back to this Greek notion again of reason. And therefore, human reason became the final judge and arbiter and determinant of what is good, bad, right, wrong, so on and so forth. And so we'll also look at the tradition within the Enlightenment that advocated and fostered, and I will still put it in the present tense, that it often advocates and fosters this kind of human-centered view toward creation and the cosmos. To begin with, a helpful and useful reminder from Thomas Aquinas. And Thomas writes in his Summa, "It is of the heart of sin that human beings use what they ought to enjoy and enjoy what they ought to use." Okay? Yeah, pretty smart guy, isn't it? Think about that. Right? The distinction here between use and enjoyment. Right? Again, it is the heart of sin that human beings use what they ought to enjoy and enjoy what they ought to use. To use something is to make it instrumental to a purpose. And some things are to be so used, right? So, for example, I am using this piece of chalk for the purpose of trying to communicate, right? So this chalk is very instrumental. It's a means to an end. The whole notion of use, again, gets us into means, ends kinds of thinking. Right? I'm using this to get something done. I use a hammer to pound in a nail. Right? The hammer is a tool. It's an instrument for a purpose. To enjoy a thing is to permit it to be what it is prior to and apart from any instrumental assessment of it. To enjoy something is to permit it to be what it is prior to and apart from any instrumental assessment of it. And so at that point, enjoyment has with it or entails some notion that whatever that thing may be, there is some kind of intrinsic value. Just by the fact that it is reason to enjoy it. You don't have to use it. You kind of let it be. Now, the anthropocentric perspective of theology and at secular cohorts of the Enlightenment and that kind of philosophy have led us to see animals and all things within creation as purely instrumental. That becomes the key problem, I would say, of this anthropocentric, this human-centered notion that animals, and here again I'm using them because it seems to be an easy case to think about with regard to certain ethical issues, but that animals and all things within creation are there simply to be used by us for purely instrumental reasons. Or as that wise philosopher Anonymous would state the case, the world is my oyster. Right, that's an anthropocentric view. More technically, Sir Francis Bacon, who is one of these Enlightenment thinkers, states, quote, "Science masters nature for the relief of man's estate. Science masters nature for the relief of man's estate." Or within our contemporary thinking, a French biologist Jacques Monod, in his book Chance and Necessity, concludes that the only purpose he could find in life was that for an organism is the DNA molecule's way of perpetuating itself. And in the self is gene, biologist Dawkins says, quote, "The purpose of our lives is to perpetuate our DNA." The purpose of our lives is to perpetuate our DNA. Well, what does this have to say about animals, for example? Well, let's go back to the 19th century, where these notions of use were very prevalent with regard to animals. And in the 19th century, one of the key moralists in North America with regard to Roman Catholic ethics and morality was a person by the name of Joseph Rickaby. And one of the things that Rickaby says with regard to animals, this is quoting him, "Brutes are as things in our regard, so far as they are useful for us. They exist for us and not for themselves. And we do right in using them unsparingly for our need and convenience, though not for our wantonness. In all that conduces to the sustenance of man, may we give pain to animals as also in the pursuit of science? Nor are we bound to any anxious care to make this pain as little as may be. We do right in using them unsparingly for our need, convenience, though not our wantonness. If, then, any special case of pain to a brute creature be a fact of considerable value for observation in biological science or the medical art, no reasoned considerations of morality can stand in the way of making the experiment. Yet so that even in the quest of science, we be mindful of mercy? Rickaby's only concern is that we should not show cruelty to animals. And why is that? Because cruelty to animals could lead to cruelty to human beings. It's the start of a bad habit. No, it's very serious. But note, right? I mean, here I think Rickaby, again, capsulizes that human-centered approach, right? We can use those animals you know, unsparingly for our need and our convenience, right? Not our wantonness, because gluttony and being wanton about things would be something that is inappropriate and should not be done. The one who counters this kind of understanding is Albert Schweitzer, right? Schweitzer, at this point, is the minority voice because he questions some of this anthropocentric point of view and these positions of animals. And in his book, Philosophy of Civilization, he says, quote, "Just as the housewife who has scrubbed out the parlor takes care that the door is kept shut so that the dog may not get in and spoil the work she has done by the marks of his paws, so do European thinkers watch carefully that no animals run about in the fields of their ethics." That whole sense of exclusion, and you know, Schweitzer's going to push that harder to say, by and large, 19th century ethical thinking wants to very much demarcate that ethics involves humans and only humans, and the rest of creation, whether that be animals or what else, stay out of the human parlor. Don't come in, don't dirty our floor, don't dirty our furniture. Right. A very anthropocentric kind of view, again, with respect to these notions and these understandings. A bit more up to date in what has now been regarded as kind of a classic article with regard to this whole notion of anthropocentrism in our relation to the rest of creation and animals. And this was an article written by Lynn White Jr. in Science in 1971 that was entitled "The Historical Roots of Our Ecologic Crisis." And in that, he says, he makes the claim that the arrogant and exploitative stance toward nature is due to the Judeo-Christian doctrine of creation. He says, quote, "By gradual stages, a loving and all-powerful God created light and darkness, the heavenly bodies, the earth and all its plants, animals, birds, and fishes. Finally, God created Adam, and as an afterthought, Eve, to keep man from being lonely. Man named all the animals, thus establishing his dominance over them. God planned all of this explicitly for man's benefit and rule. No item in the physical creation had any purpose save to serve man's purposes." Unquote. Okay? Is White right about that? Is that indeed the Judeo-Christian doctrine of creation? That what we are to get out of the doctrine of creation is that God creates the physical creation to serve human purposes. And that's it. What is the biblical perspective on the environment, ecology, animals? In many senses, certain folks would agree with him, right? For example, former Secretary of the Interior, James Watt, says when he had to explain why he wanted to put nearly 800 million acres of federally owned land for immediate corporate use, he says, quote, "My responsibility is to follow the scriptures, which call upon us to occupy the land until Jesus returns." So he thought turning these federal lands over to the corporate folks for oil exploration and mining and lumbering and so on and so forth was doing just what God wanted him to do. Others of us would say that if that were his interpretation of Genesis 1 and 2, he would probably fail Biblical Interpretation 101. I don't know what he would do with Garbology 101 and 102, but he wouldn't do too well to say that's all there is with regard to the Christian understanding of creation. Why not? Just to look at a few things that we often don't look at within the scriptures with regard to creation and, again, particularly animals. For example, several biblical laws and other declarations pertain to humane treatment of animals. Lost animals are to be returned, and those that have fallen are to be helped up. Deuteronomy 22, 1-5. Even if they belong to one's enemy, Exodus 23, 4 and 5. One is to have regard for the life of one's own beast, Proverbs 12, 10. Oxen treading grain are to be left unmuzzled. Conceivably, the famous prohibition against boiling a kid in its mother's milk reflects humane considerations and treatments of animals. Conservation interests undoubtedly inform the requirement that a nesting bird be let go. A passage from Isaiah 66, verse 3, compares slaughtering an ox to killing a person. The Deuteronomic Code prohibits wanton destruction of trees, even in times of war. Quote, "Are the trees in the field men that they should be besieged by you?" In the New Testament, Jesus implicitly commends those who would help their sheep or ox or donkey out of a pit, even if doing so might call for working on the Sabbath. Caring for one's animals, of course, is good husbandry as well as humane practice, and we see this again from passages in Proverbs. Throughout the biblical period, the Sabbath was to be a day of rest, not only for humans, but also for their cattle, meaning presumably all their domestic and farm animals. And even the wild beasts were to be remembered. They were to have what was left in the fields and orchards every seventh year when the land lay fallow, according to Exodus 23 and Leviticus 25. The idea that sacrifice of an animal could replace that of a child or propitiate for human offense attests a close relationship between human life and animal life. But while some texts assume that God desires countless sacrifices of animals, most prophetic passages indicate that God, as the source of all being and of all creation, does not desire nor require sacrifice, and in fact often denounces sacrificial slaughter. Sacrificial slaughter is denounced in Amos, Hosea, Isaiah, Jeremiah, and throughout the Psalms. You know, again, we looked yesterday at Micah chapter 6 as another one to say, you know, what does God require? Does he want all these sacrifices? Does God want you to kill 1,000 calves and sacrifice them? No. You know, let them live. What does God require? To do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God. That is the role that entails. And those are some of the things which the understanding of the role of the relationship of humans to animals is all about. To look at the Enlightenment side of all of this and what happened here. What happens here within the Enlightenment and preceding it with people like Bacon, Sir Francis Bacon, and others, is the understanding that, again, there is somehow a split between the spiritual and the material. and that indeed the understanding of human is first and foremost on this side of the spiritual, now understood also as the side of the rational and the reasonable, whereas the material is much more simply, use that technical term, stuff. It's things, and things to be used, and it was understood in a very kind of mechanistic way, that the world and even the animals within it are seen as machines. The French philosopher René Descartes, for example, as he understands the distinction between the mind and the body, and he has this kind of dualism, sees both the human body and animals and everything else within creation as pure mechanism. And he picked that up from an earlier tradition in France, because it was in France where the whole metaphor of the universe as clockwork and God as the clockmaker originated. And so we have this clockmaker God who gives us all this clockwork, and we have this mechanism. And so the universe kind of grinds on in this mechanical fashion. And we as human beings either learn how to use this mechanism or we don't. And so our task is to learn how to use it. With Isaac Newton and his understanding of physics, it reinforces this whole mechanistic view. Alexander Pope has a little doggerel poem that says, "The world was held in darkness and night. Then God said, 'Let Newton be,' and all was light." Right? Newton unlocks the secrets of the universe. Newton's uniform mathematical configuration of physics placed the workings of the cosmos on a firm mechanistic foundation. Right. Now you could tell how the world really works. And now you know how to really use it. Right. The engineers and scientists in the room are smiling a little bit. But that's the confidence. Remember, we're talking here 17th, 18th, 19th century, a very confident, optimistic time that says if human beings use their head and their reason long enough and hard enough, they'll come up with all the right answers. We'll do it. Just give us time. Confident, optimistic time. The one who puts all of this stuff together then into the most formal and coherent system is the German philosopher Immanuel Kant. And Kant has sometimes as well been labeled as the philosopher of modern Protestantism. And Kant, in all of his philosophy, and I will spare you all of that, basically works with three presuppositions. And I want to talk about those presuppositions that go into his philosophy, because I think that's what's very important. First of all, from Newton, he uses and incorporates the understanding within his philosophy that nature is a closed and lifeless system of intrinsically purposeless mass and motion. Nature subsists like a machine. The sum of appearances, insofar as they stand, in virtue of an inner principle of causality, is their interconnection. So, you've got this notion, nature is a machine. Again, it's just basically stuff, things that have to be worked with, used, manipulated, and the way you can best get at it and describe how all of that works is through the notion of cause and effect. A causes B, which causes C, and so if you, you know, can explain all of those things in terms of causality, what that really enables you to do in terms of human knowledge is it gives you the power of prediction. And therefore, you can even, and this is very attractive, know the future. Right. Where does this stuff kind of, you know, that's, ooh, we know the future because now we can plan accordingly, that since it's at 30% chance of rain today at Holden, we all got ready for the hike, and up there at Holden Lake, here comes the showers. Well, so it goes. They're wrong again, but they can give you good reasons for why they were wrong. But, you know, forecasting the weather is as is much of science, right? And not to belittle it, but that's, you know, works on a cause and effect system, that sense of prediction, like the real confidence is somehow we can, if we can tell you what happens, I mean, we know the future, we know the outcome, that's pretty important for the way we conduct our lives. And so why do we work on animals and creation? Because we want to find out what makes them tick, so we can again predict and know our future, right? Again, it becomes very anthropocentric when that our comes into view. The second presupposition of Kant is with regard to God. For Kant, God is a speculative, not a rational claim. And that is, he too has probably sat in on some discussions at Holden and elsewhere on whether or not God exists. And for someone who can give a good reason for why God exists, somebody else can give just as good a reason for why God does not exist. And they can keep going back and forth for days, for weeks, for centuries. And he says, you know, finally it ends up with regard to a notion of speculation, because if you could be rational about it, you could get back into this cause and effect kind of understanding and so on and so forth. But, right, there's no reason to despair about that, because he's not trying to say, oh, well, then let's throw out God completely. All he wants to say is note that since it's speculative, we have to remember that rationally, and remember reason is what really counts, God does not, should not enter into our rational and reasonable discussions, namely like science and creation and what's going on there. And so we need to separate or to distinguish carefully the realm of science, which is so rational and reasonable, from the realm of religion. And that becomes then the third kind of claim that, and pre-understanding that Kant wants to put forward. We need to keep these careful distinctions between science and religion, faith and reason, knowledge and revelation. And therefore, once we do that, you can again see that we've drawn a very significant distinction between those two, and what counts, what's important, is the realm of science, reason, knowledge, and of course, who truly is scientific and reasonable and knowledgeable. Well, lucky for us, it's us. So human beings then become the final authoritative norm and judge for all ethical conduct, for all cultural conduct, for all moral conduct, for all knowledge. It's all centered in us. And since it's centered in us, then what do we do with nature? What do we do with creation? What do we do with the animals? And here again, in the history of the West, there are probably four responses. These are my own images for categorizing these responses. The first response is, the world is our pantry. Creation is our pantry. Right? It's got all those resources out there. Just like the pantry stores all the food. What is it? It's up to us to go into that pantry and use them. Right. Another image. What is the world? What is creation? It's our laboratory. We go out in creation, we can use all of creation, we can use the animals, so on and so forth. To say, if the first one is for the sake of resources, this is for the sake of learning. This is the science, knowledge, prediction, all of that kind of stuff talked about. Third, what can nature be? It can be our gymnasium, right? It's the place where we can go and take a hike, right? Do recreation, have leisure, swim, boat, hunt, fish, you know, the big gymnasium out there. And fifth, what can creation be? It can be our cathedral. We can walk outside and look up at the mountains and go, wow, nature. Right. And in that sense, nature can provide us with an aesthetic experience. Right. The beauty of nature, the beauty of creation, the intricacies of the animal, so on and so forth. Okay. That becomes the anthropocentric way, I think, the ways in which we use nature. It's our pantry, it's our laboratory, our gymnasium, our cathedral. But again,
do you have the saying here in America, earlier this century, that we had back home? If it moves, shoot it. If it doesn't, cut it down.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
We did?
Yeah, I've seen it.
Okay.
Thank you. Kind of ties in with
it. Yeah, it definitely ties in with this, but yeah, I wasn't familiar with that phrase.
We have altered it. We're starting to be enlightened.
But there again, you see, those are the senses. That's that anthropocentric view. Now, what might counter that view? And again, even within this time, let me suggest just one response to it. And I want to, again, sticking within this historical period, look at the response made by G.K. Chesterton in his book Orthodoxy, which was published in 1908, and this is from his chapter on the ethics of Elfland, where he is criticizing Herbert Spencer, the social Darwinist. And he says about Herbert Spencer, he says, Herbert Spencer would have been greatly annoyed if anyone had called him an imperialist. And therefore, it is highly regrettable that no one did. But he was an imperialist of the lowest type. Now, why does Chesterton take that kind of dig at Spencer in the ethics of Elfland and this whole, because again, Spencer is the one who by and large sees the world as pantry, laboratory, gymnasium. He doesn't even have a whole lot to say about the cathedral aspect, but you know, these kinds of things become very central to him and to others within this time. Here's Chesterton's alternative and response to this. He says, all the towering materialism which dominates the modern mind rests ultimately upon one assumption, a false assumption. It is supposed that if a thing goes on repeating itself, it is probably dead, a piece of clockwork. People feel that if the universe was personal, it would vary. If the sun were alive, it would dance. This is a fallacy even in relation to known fact. For the variation in human affairs is generally brought into them, not by life, but by death, by the dying down or breaking off of their strength or desire. A man varies his movements because of some slight element of failure or fatigue. He gets into an omnibus because he is tired of walking, or he walks because he is tired of sitting still. But if his life and joy were so gigantic that he never tired of going to Islington, he might go to Islington as regularly as the Thames goes to Sheerness. The very speed and ecstasy of his life would have the stillness of death. The sun rises every morning. I do not rise every morning, but the variation is due not to my activity, but to my inaction. Now, to put the matter in a popular phrase, it might be true that the sun rises regularly because he never gets tired of rising. His routine might be due not to a lifelessness, but to a rush of life. The thing I mean can be seen, for instance, in children, when they find some game or joke that they specially enjoy. A child kicks his legs rhythmically through excess, not absence, of life. Because children have abounding vitality, because they are in spirit fierce and free, therefore they want things repeated and unchanged. They always say, "Do it again," and the grown-up person does it again until he is nearly dead. For grown-up people are not strong enough to exult in monotony. But perhaps God is strong enough to exult in monotony. It is possible that God says every morning, "Do it again," to the sun, and every evening, "Do it again," to the moon. It may not be automatic necessity that makes all daisies alike. It may be that God makes every daisy separately, but has never got tired of making them. It may be that God has the eternal appetite of infancy, for we have sinned and grown old, and our Father is younger than we. The repetition in nature may not be a mere recurrence. It may be a theatrical encore. Heaven may encore the bird who laid an egg. If the human being conceives and brings forth a human child instead of bringing forth a fish or a bat or a griffin, the reason may not be that we are fixed in an animal fate without life or purpose. It may be that our little tragedy has touched the gods, that they admire it from their starry galleries, and that at the end of every human drama, man is called again and again before the curtain. Repetition may go on for millions of years by mere choice, and at any instance it may stop. Man may stand on the earth generation after generation, and yet each birth be his positively last appearance. This was my first conviction, made by the shock of my childish emotions meeting the modern creed in mid-career. I had always vaguely felt facts to be miracles in the sense that they are wonderful. Now I began to think them miracles in the stricter sense, that they were willful. I mean that they were or might be repeated exercises of some will. In short, I had always believed that the world involved magic. Now I thought that perhaps it involved a magician. And this pointed a profound emotion, always present and subconscious, that this world of ours has some purpose. And if there is a purpose, there is a person. I had always felt life first as a story, And if there is a story, there is a storyteller. So much for Chesterton. One last comment. And that is, it seems that as we as Christians look at creation and from our understanding of creation, it would seem that the first basic movement that we would have in this story is one of appreciation, an awareness, an affirmation on the part of one being for another. We can read in Genesis, in Job, in the Psalms, in the book of Revelation, that the response of God to creation is always one of wonder and amazement and delight about the created world. There is an active caring for all creatures, and that images God's creative activity. Perhaps again, Thomas is right, that the real understanding of sin is that we use what we are supposed to enjoy, and we enjoy what we are supposed to use. It's all yours. Thank you. Comments?
Sure. If you take a good, hard look at the creation story, it is, I would say, the strongest argument for the statement that man created God and God did not create man.
Do you want to say a little bit more about that?
Take a look at what Genesis says. It is one of the strongest points of egotism that you can think of. God created man in his own image.
Yeah, but is that, as it stands within Genesis 1, immediately a notion of egotism, or is that an egotistic interpretation, which in fact, indeed, in truth, is a bad interpretation? Right? I mean, see, that's one of the things that Lynn White Jr. wants to point out in his article, is that as he reads the history of the interpretation of Genesis in Western civilization, there's really one little phrase that they like to zero in on, right? And that's in Genesis chapter 1, verse 28. Right? Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over fish of the sea, birds of the air, every living thing that moves on the earth. And so what we say, oh yeah, Genesis, subdue, have dominion. Good, I can use things the way I want to. Well, you know, like I said, that's what James Watt thinks too, but I think he'd flunk most exegetical courses at the SEM if he'd write a paper on that, as that's what Genesis 1 says.
My interpretation of Genesis 1 and 2 is Genesis 1:26. Let us make man in our image after our likeness. And it's plural. And let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over the cattle and over the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. So God created man in his own image, in the image of God. He created the male and female. He created them, and God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea. And that means to me, take care of this earth.
Uh-huh.
Because you've been created in our image. And you have what the angels have, and you have this special quality of appreciation, and you have everything that is needed to understand that you do not use this earth just for your leisure or aesthetic feelings or learning or your own resources.
but you take care of this earth.
Mm-hmm.
And you you deliver it from what's going to happen, because you could see.
Mm-hmm. Most, again, in the history of Christian theology in the West, most theologians and commentators on this text, you know, trying to say, okay, well, what is meant by this term, image of God? Does it mean, well, you know, we look like God? Well, I mean, obviously that can't be the case. I mean, we all can't look like God.
Unless you're Mormon. Unless you're Mormon.
Unless you're Mormon, okay. But you know, again, that image of God is not to be understood in terms of physicality, but it is to be understood in terms of a relationship, right? And to be in God's image means that we are in a relationship with God and creation in the same way that God is in relationship with us and creation. And that's what? That's that caretaking, that giving. That it's the understanding of being the steward, right? To use that old archaic kind of term.
But this all is basically preservation and perpetuation of our own DNA.
No. No, that isn't it, Deanne.
Certainly we're influenced by the history of the interpretation of those passages, but we also move from the history of it. And it seems to me that one of the interesting ways of turning to that passage that comes out kind of where Chris does is to say dominion, which is the same notion as lordship, for Christians should be understood with reference to the Lord, who is Jesus. And that suggests a very different way of having dominion than the interpretation that caused Lynn White to write a very scathing analysis of Christian impact on the environment, which is probably deserved to a certain degree.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not particularly critical of White's article in terms of saying, oh, he's a bad exegete of Genesis 1 and 2. No, I mean, what he has done for us as Christians is, again, confront us with the fact that we as Christians have been bad interpreters of Genesis 1 and 2. And what Deanne is saying here links back to some of the stuff yesterday. How do you understand Genesis 1 and 2, that notion of image of God, of dominion? Well, who is our Lord? Who is the one who has dominion over us? Christ. Well, that means we ought to look again at Colossians 1, 15 to 20 to say, how is that lordship exercised? By the cross. Look at Romans chapter 8, which we did. How is that lordship exercised? Through God's steadfast love incarnate in Christ. Now, if we do that in creation, right, we're not just going to be users. Yeah, I mean, that's again why for us as Christians, Romans 8, Colossians 1, and texts like that, the resurrection, the life of Jesus, become paradigmatic for the way we understand creation.
How much of that which you've just said is related to the decline of the West, so that when the West is no longer as dominant as it was once, we need to re-look at the way we view Scripture and so on? I understand that as a historical dimension and perspective too, but it seems to me that we have to do that.
You mean look at,
that's not a criticism of you or anything.
You mean saying since we don't have as much dominion as we used to, we better change our interpretation?
I wonder how much our interpretation of Scripture is determined by the environment and culture in which we live.
I think there's a significant back and forth that goes. I mean, our context influences the way we interpret the text, and the text interprets the way in which we understand our context. And I would love to talk to you for years about all that hermeneutical stuff, but I will restrain myself. But no, it's an important point between text and context. And yet, let me make this perhaps unpopular point about this notion of dominion and all of that kind of stuff. Matthew Fox, The Coming of the Cosmic Christ. And again, he too said, you know, Mother Earth is dying and all of that stuff for you who are familiar with Fox. But how do we get out of it? This is page 38 in his text here. How do we get out of it? He says, the link, I believe, lies in the human psyche's capacity for resurrection, for aliveness, wakefulness, awareness, and rebirth. In short, mysticism. Yet the West is ignorant of mysticism, of its own mystics, for reasons we will explore. If we can awaken to an authentic mysticism, then a resurrection of Mother Earth is possible. I look at that and I say, if that's creation-centered spirituality, if that's the program to which we're called, you know, as Carl said, we know where that one's going to go. We're going to fail, right? The human psyche's capacity for resurrection? No, right? We're dead. It is God who makes us alive. And the only way our human psyche is going to have a chance again is if God gives it life, right? We have to be more than awakened, right? We have to be brought back to life. And again, is it just that the West is ignorant? No, I mean, that's good old 19th century liberalism. What's the problem? Ignorance. What's the solution? Enlightenment. Well, we've tried that for the last two centuries. Where does it get us? Garbology 101 and 102, and we're talking about what are we doing now with what we've done to our world? Right? I mean, that's an old solution that doesn't work, quite frankly. Go Taro and then back to the
quickly, Principles in Garbology 202, which I had the opportunity to take at first, is that science, as used in that model, is science of the 18th century.
Yes.
When we thought, if we only knew a little more, we would understand it all. I think the model is much looser now. I'm trying to think of the correct term as floppy logic. The cause-effect relationship is a lot looser than what we used to think it was. And in fact, one of the most reliable methods of predicting the weather tomorrow is ask yourself, what is it doing right now, today? As it turns out, statistically, that's the case. But so there's not necessarily a direct cause and effect kind of relationship, and we as scientists and engineers realize that. The second thing is, I think part of our role as stewards and as children of God is to realize that we are not as powerful as we really think we are. The earth is not dying. We are just not that powerful to do that to God's creation. Not only is it our responsibility not to do that, but we cannot, through our worst devices, I think, actually destroy creation, because we have to remember that trees die, plants die, fish die. And if we're worried about a tree dying here or a tree dying there, that is not necessarily God's plan that they never die. And so there's some misunderstanding about what we're trying to preserve in a static sense. I don't know that God intends the world to be static. So I guess the last implication is that to be good stewards, we cannot trade the life of a tree for the well-being of a person. To say, well, the hell with them in Southern California, we won't export any water or electricity down there, that's too bad, we're not going to build any more dams up here, that sort of thing. I don't think we're called to trade human lives and well-being for things.
But just to respond to what Carl said, certainly there's an urgency in the current situation that causes us to ask these questions. But when we ask them, we discover that there's a long, somewhat submerged portion of our tradition that takes this interpretation. So it's not as though it's a novel interpretation that's called on only by the current situation.
Mm-hmm. Our time is up, and so, you know, as you heard the bell, so I encourage, you know, if any of you would like to leave, please do so. But I'll stay back here for a few minutes yet for those who want to talk, discuss.